Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
And many miracles to all for this new year. Welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsburg. I'm Fran Ginsburg, and our show tonight is sponsored by Starseed Gems. They can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Our guest tonight is Leslie Kane, and if you have a question, comment, or you'd like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number here is 888-627-6008. So, Happy New Year, Bob.
And Happy New Year to you. And as you mentioned, our guest tonight, Leslie, is going to be talking about something that we haven't yet talked about on this show. And after you hear her, you'll know why we invited her. She's an expert in the field of UFOs, so fascinating. I'm like everybody else, freezing. Probably 75% of the country is in a deep freeze, so...
I think it's more than that.
Yeah.
I think they showed the weather map last night. So
brutal, but at least the good thing is that we haven't had a lot of snow here,
and oil prices have dropped.
Yeah, so not so bad.
Correct.
So I saw an article in the newspaper about this elderly couple, sisters, Martha Dixon and Mary Dixon, who lived together, and they both passed away hours apart on Christmas Day. And the story is that they're twin sisters. They were each 90 years old. They shared a very, very strong bond. Her family says it was a bond like no other. One of the sisters passed away, and a couple of hours later, I think 2 hours later, the other sister passed, and they, you know, it was peaceful. They didn't have any particular, you know, illness, I don't think, other than, you know, being elderly. And the granddaughter of one of the deceased sisters said, you know, she said, for twins to go out on the same day like that, 2 hours apart, it's like one had to take the steps to pass away and then help the other one get through that. So, you know, I was thinking about that. You know, so often we read these stories. It's quite common that married couples, partners, people that have had a strong bond for many, many, many years die close, you know, could sometimes it's hours, sometimes it's days, sometimes it's a week, but it's very close proximity. And the explanation always is, they died of a broken heart.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, some people, yeah, I mean, obviously, many of our listeners have suffered losses, and they've had their hearts broken, you know, and they survived it. You know, so maybe it is more of a case of it was time, and one person takes the initiative to step through that door and brings the other one over. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's fabulous, because we're always thinking about, you know, when we choose to incarnate, that we select our birth date and our exit date, or at least our method of exiting the world. And here, the method was just, okay, let's go. Let's just go. We're done. Let's go. I like that. You don't have to have any trauma. You don't have to have a disease. You don't have to give up your quality of life. These two young ladies were very blessed.
Yeah, well, I mean, they... I don't know whether you could say it was a conscious, you know, decision of the first one to go, you know, but it happened, you know, and when it happened, she took action, you know, we know that people have, you know, visions, deathbed visions, near-death visions, where they see their loved one as clear as day, you know, so maybe, you know.
Okay, so when you say a conscious decision,
right,
which consciousness are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, the human conscious awareness, you know.
Because I'm saying at that point, they may have had, we don't know, maybe they've had a conversation about, you know, we live wonderful lives, and maybe now it's time for us to focus on some sort of an exit. Maybe we don't know the background
right to
this story.
Well, so, you know, so when one of the sisters, you know, passed, and then we're assuming made herself appear to the other, and, you know, with a welcoming thing, probably saying, okay, it's time to go. Then we have to say, well, then it was her time. Like, nobody was saying to the other sister, no, you have to remain. You have work left to do.
Right.
There was no work left to do. She did what she was supposed to do, and it was time. Maybe, you know, maybe there's another case where it wouldn't be, even though one sister was welcoming the other, it wasn't the other sister's time. So she wouldn't step through, even though she was being welcomed. That possibility exists too, right?
Right. There's also the possibility that they didn't do it with the intention of one welcoming the other. It's just like they both decided they were done, and one happened to exit the physical world before the other. The same way one was born before the other. Did the one who was born first exit first? Do they give you that information?
No, you know, it wasn't in the article, so it didn't say. But that would be interesting, you know, if the one who was a little, you know, a couple of hours older, you know, left a couple of hours before.
Well, you can't be a couple of hours. Well, I guess you can.
You could.
It's a terrible birth for the mom. But.
Yeah. I know also we've been working on, you know, we have a retreat in Connecticut in July.
July 24th through 26th.
Yeah, and we in the past we've had pretty much termed it as a grief retreat, and there was a heavy emphasis on that. This year, we're broadening the horizon, so to speak, and, you know, it's going to be more of an afterlife exploration retreat, you know.
Right, but it does also provide the information, the material, and the support for people who are in grief and are searching for the afterlife,
right,
evidence of it.
So it'd be, you know, for people that are interested or curious, as well as, you know, people, you know, that are grieving the loss, because there'll be plenty of information and hands-on exercises. So we'll have more information as it develops, and we'll be putting it up on the website. I think we're close to that. So, we're also putting together our next newsletter.
Go out soon.
So
first week in February.
We've changed that up a bit.
Oh, it's going to be gorgeous. Everybody has to look for it.
Bigger color.
Bigger, glossy color, new design. FFF is in.
Yeah, we've got a lot of exciting.
A lot of new things coming.
I know we mentioned, some people may not be aware, if you go on our website, there is a Visionary Explorers group.
Another exciting thing that we've just started.
I mean, it's also free, and it's for people who have had visions and signs and want to talk to other people about it. It's a chat room on the,
it's a video conference room. It's small, and it's run by Dr. Betty Kovach of the Comlock Center.
Right.
So
this is a joint project of for the Family Foundation and Comlock Center, and then Dr. Kovach
is overly qualified for leading a group like this.
Oh, yeah.
So the feedback from the first few meetings of the group number one, which has already started meeting, is absolutely fabulous.
Right. So you can go on the website, foreverfamilyfoundation.org, and find out more information about that. We're going to go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to speak with our guest, Leslie Kane. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
Hello, I am Lloyd Auerbach, parapsychologist and author. You can learn much more about life after death, precognition, mind-matter interactions, remote viewing, ghost hunting, and other psychic experiences and research through the acclaimed Distance Learning Parapsychological Studies program at HCH Institute. Our courses are audio-based with additional written and video material. Call HCH at 925-283-3941 or visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com. Our courses include The Search for Life After Death, Being Psychic, Psychokinesis and Precognition, Ghost Hunting, Theories and Models of Psychic Experience, and more. Taken singly or as part of the certificate program, these courses will enrich your knowledge of parapsychology and the range of psychic phenomena. You'll learn about being psychic yourself. Visit www.hypnotherapytraining.com or call 925-283-3941 for information about our individual distance learning courses and certificate program.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide a forum where individuals and families who have suffered the loss of a loved one can turn for support, information, and hope. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. The Forever Family Foundation is a joint effort of scientists, research mediums, and interested people who support the premise that life does not end with physical death. We wish to prove that the bond of the family cannot be broken even by death. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707. That's 631-425-7707. Or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. After-death communication is an accepted occurrence in many cultures throughout the world. But for many others, proof of this phenomenon is essential. And research shows that contact helps move people through loss and grief. The Sign Registry allows people to register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to specific loved ones. Contact the Forever Family Foundation at foreverfamilyfoundation.org or go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
For those just tuning in, our guest tonight is Leslie Kane. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, and they can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Bob?
And Leslie Kane has quite a resume. She's an investigative journalist. She's contributed articles to dozens of publications here and abroad, including, just to name a few, the Boston Globe, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. I can go on and on. Her stories have been syndicated through Knight Ridder Tribune, Scripps Howard, New York Times Wire Service, Pacific News Service, and the National Publishers Association. She began covering the UFO subject in 2000 with a feature story in the Boston Globe, and followed with additional mainstream stories. In 2002, she co-founded the Coalition for Freedom of Information, an independent alliance advocating for greater government openness on information about UFOs and for responsible coverage by the media based on a rational and credible approach. As director of the CFI, she was the plaintiff in a successful 5-year Freedom of Information Act federal lawsuit against NASA, and in 2007, she co-organized a landmark Washington, D.C. international press conference on official UFO investigations, which received media coverage all around the world. She is the author of the best-selling book on UFOs. It's called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. You can find more about the book and Leslie on the website, UFOsOnTheRecord.com. Welcome to Signs of Life, Leslie.
Well, thanks, Bob. It's really a pleasure to be with you tonight. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure, and I have to say, you know, because of the nature of our work at the Foundation, which is involved, obviously, in parapsychology and survival, you know, we never had the opportunity to discuss, you know, credible UFO research, and I've always been interested in the subject, and after reading your book, I was really struck, you know, by the similarities that UFO researchers and parapsychologists have. I mean, namely, having evidence ignored or dismissed, the stigma attached to the researchers, those sanctions against those who dare to go on the record. And so as your research progressed, well, I should say before your research even started, were you aware of these obstacles, or is this something that surprised you as you started to get into it?
It actually kind of did surprise me. I mean, I wasn't aware of it because I sort of jumped in on this work based on this report that I got from France, which in 1999, which really just as a journalist just kind of blew my mind, really, because it was written by high-level generals and admirals and very high-level people in France. I won't go into a lot about that, but it was just sort of what got me rolling. And when I read this report, which was written by these distinguished people, and it was very matter-of-fact, they made the conclusion that they thought, the reports that they studied, which were among the most credible official reports in the world, they thought that it was a valid and rational hypothesis to deduce from that these were likely vehicles that were extraterrestrial. I mean, they thought that was extremely rational. And I you know, as a journalist, I thought, you know, that was a big deal for somebody, people like that, to make that kind of conclusion. So I thought, wow, this is a big story. And I was kind of naive about what the point that you were just making, because I just jumped in. And although I was aware of it enough, though, Bob, to not want to tell all my colleagues who I was working with at the time at a public radio station in Berkeley, California, I didn't want anybody else to know I was involved with this topic.
Right.
So, you know, I was certainly concerned about it. And but I was also so taken by the fact that these French people were not affected by that, and they were very outspoken about it. And the credentials that they had carried so much weight. So when I finally wrote that first story in the Boston Globe, I was kind of off and running. But I was certainly aware of this, and that's partly why I wanted to do the research, was to find out, you know, what the origin of it was, why there was a stigma for something for which there was so much evidence and so much interesting data that had been collected for decades, and it was officially on the record. So why was there this problem with it? That really intrigued me.
Yeah, and again, this is another parallel, you know, with the work that we do, is that, you know, the sheer amount of the credible data exists, and not very few people are aware of it. And that's what shocked me when I got into this kind of work. And so when you started to get deeper and deeper into it, and you found that, you know, people with data banks of thousands of stories and you know, high-level intelligent people that, you know, that were coming up with the well, actually, it was more of a it wasn't a hypothesis. They were convinced that not necessarily that they were extraterrestrial, but that there are unidentified objects that can do things that violate all the laws of physics. So I mean, this had to shock you, and I'm sure you got more and more intrigued as you learn more and more.
Absolutely right. I mean, I was just awed by it. And yeah. You're right. The more you learn, as I'm sure is true for you and your work too, the more it kind of builds and it makes what you're doing even stronger. It's not the opposite, because the debunker would say, well, if you just start studying this, you'll realize it all falls apart. But it doesn't. It just gets more and more solidified, and there is so much evidence. And what I was drawn mostly to were the scientists and the government officials, which are the people featured in my book, and the military people at high levels, because I knew as a journalist that those people are not going to be able to be debunked and ridiculed.
Yeah.
Because these people carry authority. It's just the way it is in our country. I mean, I'm not saying that their stories are any more valid than somebody else's, but their stories are often very well documented. I mean, I wouldn't even call them stories. You know, the cases that I've represented in the book, which are presented by people like that, are so well documented that there's absolutely no way that you can argue with them.
Yeah.
And that all the various options of explanation for these events have been ruled out by scientists and government officials and people who are in a position to acquire the necessary information to be able to rule them out. I mean, you have to have a lot of data to be able to rule out, you know, the 10 possible things that might explain these things.
Yeah.
And, you know, civilians who have sightings aren't in a position to go through that process. But when you have a sighting at a military base or involving pilots or something that might be endangering an aircraft, or, you know, aviation authorities are involved, you have a sighting at over O'Hare Airport, or things that, you know, are so well documented or of concern enough that you can do the proper investigation. Those are the cases that really prove that there is something there. There is a phenomenon there. It's not just hoaxes or misidentifications or misinterpretations of other things. There's something going on here.
Yeah, well, let's get into a little bit, of the evidence. I mean, a lot. I know personally, I was totally ignorant of the evidence. And, you know, to me, if you mention UFOs, the only thing that came to mind was Roswell. That's all I knew. I had no way of judging whether that was a hoax or not. But right off in the book, you discuss what happened in the I think it was the late 90s or around 2000, the Belgian wave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's actually the late 90s. It was 89 to 90, so it was late 80s, early 90s.
There were 2,000 reported cases. So tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, this is one of the more incredible events, I believe, ever with UFOs. I'm glad you mentioned it. It began in, I think, November of 89, and there were the first night there were something like, I think there were 13 police, and I might not get everything here right, but I think there were 13 police officers who saw this in lots of different locations, and there were these couple of these triangular objects that were flying over a small area in the eastern part of Belgium. And the interesting thing about this is that these objects repeated themselves and kept making visits over Belgium for like a year and a half. 2 years. It's very unusual because most sightings are just a one-time event.
Hmm.
And so because of that, the government became actively involved. The Air Force really made an effort to try and identify these things. And they had protocols set up by which they would launch their jets up to try to take closer looks if certain criteria had been met in terms of making it worth their while to do that. And they felt they had to do it because airspace was being invaded by something. That they, you know, there are rules of how you behave within the airspace over countries, and these things were violating that. And so they had an obligation to deal with it. And they were demonstrating, as you mentioned, technology that we don't have access to. I mean, they were able to do extraordinary things, these objects. And they were reported by countless people, many of them military people, police officers, and they were never able to figure out what they were. And the Air Force, who was a colonel at the time, Wilfried de Brouwer, who later became a major general, very high-level official in Belgium, was the person behind the investigation, and he wrote a chapter in my book just describing the whole thing. And he is such an authority. I mean, you read this thing written in his words, And, you know, you're absolutely baffled. He went around to the different NATO offices. He went around to the American, you know, officials and inquired, quietly inquired as to whether these could belong to anybody, and he was told no, and he had every reason to believe what he was being told. So he's convinced that these were not man-made objects. And we're sort of stuck with that. Nobody's done anything about it. It just sits there. But to me, that's a huge thing. It's a big story, and nobody really pays attention.
Yeah, it really, it's quite incredible. And I, for instance, a lot of people use the argument, well, you know, that these objects are the product of our own, you know, advanced technology that's kept secret, and what we see are countries testing it out. But when you look at that, you know, assuming that were true, and it's beyond, you know, any present principles of physics, wouldn't you think that some of this technology would have spilled over to practical applications over the last 60 years? I mean, if we had that technology, how would we keep it? Why would we keep it secret for 60 years? It just makes no logical sense to me.
I know, and that's what the military people tell me. And General DeBrower, who he says even 20 years later, he says there's no technology that can do what those things could do. And we had these things going on in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, doing the same kinds of things. So it's certainly true that many times people will see advanced aircraft, especially in, you know, around Nevada and places, and they might mistake those things for UFOs. I mean, many sightings that people have can be explained.
Right.
So it's not like that doesn't happen, the scenario you just described, but it in no way explains all the sightings. And at high levels, governments can find out from other governments whether there were test flights going on. And a lot of these official investigations, such as the one in Belgium, had access to that kind of information, and they were told no. So it doesn't explain away the phenomenon, that's for sure.
Right. Now, you briefly mentioned it before, and you have to talk about this a little bit. I know it's in the book, that there was an event in 2006 at O'Hare Airport, and I was just shocked to read about it, and then was
yeah,
scratching my head.
it's almost laughable, isn't it?
Yeah, I know it was on the front page of the Chicago paper, but I would think that it would spread like wildfire all over the world, and it didn't. So just tell us what happened.
Okay, it took place in the late afternoon, maybe between 4:30 and 5 on a day in, I think, November 2006. And it was a hazy kind of normal weather day. And what happened was, over a particular gate, it was actually gate C-17, which was part of the United Airlines terminal, one of their gates, a lot of ground personnel saw this disc-shaped object just hovering over the terminal. It was just kind of suspended in midair, and a lot of people saw it from the ground. And that included pilots who were sitting there in their planes, and they were leaning out the windows, and people were communicating about it on the radios. There was just this big buzz at the airport. You know, managers were running out of their offices to look at it, and people, the baggage handlers, were looking at it. And it was up there for probably about 5 minutes, I mean, a long, long time. And then what happened was it shot straight up through a cloud bank that was right above it. It was just hovering under a thick cloud bank. And it kind of just went straight up through the cloud bank. And if you were standing below it and looked up, people described seeing a hole that was cut through the cloud so that they could see the blue sky on the other side of the cloud. So it was like this clean, crisp hole, sort of like if a cookie cutter coming down through the clouds. And there's no aircraft we know of that can do something like that. It shot up extremely fast and made this hole. And so this event happened, and there was absolutely nothing done about it. There's no investigation or anything done about it by our government. But when the authorities were pressed for information, they made up a couple of ridiculous explanations. The first one was that it was airport lights reflecting on the bottom of the clouds. Now, then it turned out the airport lights had not even been turned on yet because it was too light out. So
right.
They had to find literally, they said that.
Yeah.
These were the FAA authorities who were pressed to come up with something. And then the second explanation was that it was something called a hole punch cloud, and I called them up about it and made them talk to me about that more, because originally they just said a weather phenomenon. You know, as if these pilots and these people could not discern the difference between a weather phenomenon and something else, a disc, right?
Right.
But anyway, that's what they said, and then I knew what they were talking about. And I called them up, and they said it was something called a hole punch cloud, which is just when a natural hole will form in a cloud because of ice crystals coming down from above and melting a hole in the cloud. And that's a natural phenomenon that happens, but that's not what happened at O'Hare. And they came up with that explanation. And then after that, I called a bunch of scientists who were experts in cloud physics and weather and so on, and asked them about hole punch clouds. And they told me that in order for a hole punch cloud to form, it had to be below freezing because it involved ice crystals. And it turned out that the weather that day at O'Hare Airport was well above freezing. I think it was in the 50s. So that made it a physical impossibility for their explanation to have been what happened. And so that was sort of the end of the story. Nothing happened except for these phony explanations being put out there. And the witnesses, of course, I mean, as a person, I feel for these witnesses, because some of them were very kind of a little bit frightened or confused by what they saw, and they were not given the respect of our government, you know, accepting what they were saying as being true. Mm. They're completely ignored and told that what they saw was something that they didn't see.
So
that's very unfair to them.
Yeah. So there seems to be, you know, at least in this country, this pattern of disinformation that's been going on for decades. And why do you suppose that is? I mean, is our government trying to protect us, as they claim in so many other things, or do they feel that they have all this information that they don't want it to get out because they feel that we won't be able to handle it? Or, you know, what do you make
of
it?
Yeah, I mean, we really don't know, because we don't know what they might have that we don't know about.
Yeah.
Right, so it's sort of speculative. I mean, I think it's just such a hard question to answer, and I think the roots of it go back decades, when the whole sort of debunking program was put into effect back in the 50s by
right.
the CIA mainly.
Blue Book?
What's that?
Project Blue Book. What years was that?
Project Blue Book was from around the, like, say, 51 to 1970. It was about 20 years. And that was an Air Force program that was set up to kind of manage the public reports on UFOs. And it was basically a kind of a debunking public relations effort that did some good investigations, but mostly its purpose was to sort of provide phony explanations for cases, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, in 1953, the CIA held a kind of a meeting where they handpicked a bunch of scientists to come together to address the problem of UFOs, and they wrote up this document recommending that the intelligence communities debunk UFOs, and they actually used the word, we need a program of debunking. And they sort of put this into effect and also said that civilian groups should be infiltrated, and that the whole issue needed to be under control, so because the public was so involved with it. And so the whole debunking as a tool was kind of set in motion then, and I think it's just sort of built up its own momentum.
Mm.
And as to what I mean, and the government, I think the government's main position is just to try to not be involved at all. I mean, mainly, most government officials don't know anything about UFOs, and they're not concerned about UFOs, and I can understand that. So it's quite possible that there's not a whole lot that they know any more than anybody else, and if they recognize that this is something beyond our control, they would just as soon not focus on it, because what are they going to say to people?
Yeah, I understand. Absolutely. You know, and most of these, I shouldn't say most, but quite a number of the sightings come obviously from pilots, because they're in the air, and they come from commercial pilots and private pilots and military pilots. So I would think that they're really expert witnesses, because they're up there, they're looking to protect their own safety and the safety of their passengers. So to me, you know, they're extremely credible witnesses. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely agree. I think some of the most important cases on the record have to do with pilots. And
yeah.
they're trained to recognize everything that flies. so they're sitting there on the alert. So they are extremely good witnesses, and the last thing they want to do is make up stories about UFOs because of the repercussions. I mean, most of them don't report them because of those repercussions.
Right.
So the ones that do, you can be sure they're not making things up. You know, and they're excellent observers and excellent witnesses. Absolutely.
Yeah, we're gonna have to go to a break, but it is sad. You know, we live in an era where anything on a plane gets investigated. You know, if there's a bird strike, there's a team from the FAA that'll investigate the heck out of it. But yet you have sightings and nobody pays attention.
I know.
Or about that.
It's irrational, is what it is.
Yeah. We're talking with Leslie Kane, the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. We have much more to talk about, so stay with us.
Starseed Gems Studios in Cocoa, Florida fuses cremation ashes within art glass, making beautiful stones. The ashes are visible in the darkness and resemble a beautiful night sky. Starseed Gems, developed by the parents of a young man who passed away, are set in hand-sculpted silver and gold settings. Prices start at $150. Visit www.starseedgems.com or call 321-632-7770. That's www.starseedgems.com or 321-632-7770.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Winbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Winbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org. Winbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
If you're just tuning in, our guest tonight is Leslie Kane. Our sponsor is Starseed Gems, and they can be found on the web at starseedgems.com. Before we get back to our show, it's time for some foundation updates for our listeners. Samsung's CEO, Boo Koon Yoon, tells us we have entered the era of LOT, that is IoT, that is Internet of Things. And he predicts that by 2017, we'll be taking care of all of our household chores from our smart devices. And for the past few years, we've all been engaging in this activity, as shopping online not only saves us time and money, but is also so popular that the traditional Black Friday is now, in November, is now followed by Cyber Monday. So when you do shop on the Internet, please keep Forever Family Foundation in mind. By doing one simple task when you shop, you can financially support the work of Forever Family Foundation, a 100% volunteer not-for-profit organization, without sending us any money at all. Since many of us shop on Amazon, using any one of the Amazon links or book links on the Forever Family Foundation website to take you to the Amazon site is the only step you need to take before you start shopping. This will result in a donation from Amazon to us based on a dollar percentage of everything that goes into your shopping cart. And what if you don't shop on Amazon? Not a problem. There's another way to be certain that almost all your website shopping produces a donation to Forever Family Foundation without you having to send us anything. Visit iGive.com, sign up, and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Go ahead, it's free. And just like with Amazon, a portion of your spending results in a donation to Forever Family Foundation. Once you set it up, each time you shop on the Internet, iGive.com will automatically send us a donation when you shop in one of their more than 1,500 online stores that you're probably already shopping in, like L.L. Bean, Adobe, Bloomingdale's, or the Apple Store. How about Sirius Radio, Snapfish, and Travelocity? So please take a moment when you shop to show us that you care. Our Earth to Holidays Past raffle, the winners have been announced and contacted, and we want to thank everybody for supporting the work of Forever Family Foundation with your raffle purchases. And thank you all for the wonderful outpouring of the year-end donations. All this support helps us to continue and expand our free services, so watch for more of those. And if you didn't get into the Holidays Past raffle in time, or you want another chance at winning up to 5 one-hour medium readings, the Holiday of the Earth raffle 2015 is up on the website just waiting for your entries. And the mediums in this raffle are Lynn LeClaire, Renee Buck, Amy Usman, Renata Santarelli, and Tracy Bray. And don't forget to mark your calendars for the annual Afterlife Exploration Retreat in Chester, Connecticut, this July 24th through 26th. Watch for announcements on the website, to our members only in our emails for early bird pricing, and in our brand new Signs of Life newsletter coming to your mailbox soon. And finally, Forever Family Foundation's signature cherry chocolates, handmade by Professor Paranormal at Haunted by Chocolate, makes the perfect gift for you, someone you love, or someone who has had a recent loss and would treasure this special gift from you. Chocolate is the food of the gods, is the food for a healthy heart, and we all know how chocolate helps us heal the soul. Watch for your emails for this special limited offer, or look for it on the website. Visit foreverfamilyfoundation.org for all event links, information, and registration. And if you are a business interested in advertising on this show, contact us via email at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. Back to you, Bob.
And we are talking with Leslie Kane. Her last name is spelled K-E-A-N. She's the author of UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. The website is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. And Leslie, you still with us?
I sure am.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. Well, you know, quite a number of years back now, I remember Fran and I watched a documentary on what they call the Phoenix Lights. And lo and behold, you have a chapter in your book that talk about these sightings with information that blew my mind, that I never knew about, you know, Governor Fife Symington. So I remember my reaction when first seeing, you know, the film and learning about it was that, you know, how is it possible that thousands of people could see the same thing and I'm just learning about it then, and it wasn't a worldwide story. So I know it's fascinating. Can you tell us a little bit of what happened in Phoenix and the governor's tie-in with that?
Yeah, it happened on an evening in March of 1997 when it's probably up to, I mean, let's just be conservative and say 1,000 people, but there, over a period of about an hour and a half, there were two or three objects that were kind of hanging out over Arizona, moving basically from north to south, and they traversed large cities like Phoenix and other cities, very slowly kind of gliding over, and what most witnesses said was so striking about them was how massively huge they were and how silent they were. They were mainly boomerang-shaped, just gliding eerily silently with a row of lights on them and absolutely huge. Some people said they thought they were a mile long or something like that. And it is odd that, it was, the main story about this came out a couple of months later in the newspaper USA Today. It was a big story out of it. But for those couple of months in between, although it was of great concern to the people of Arizona, it just didn't get a lot of coverage. When the USA Today story came out, then it was on the evening news on CBS and some of the other stations. But like every other event, it just gets some attention and then it's over. But what was interesting about this one, as you mentioned, Governor Feist-Symington, who was the governor at the time, held a press conference around the time of the USA Today article and kind of spoofed the whole thing. Dressed up somebody in a Martian outfit and made fun of it, which was of tremendous concern and upset to the people who were witnesses. And fast forward 10 years after that, the 10-year anniversary of the event, Governor Symington acknowledged that he, in fact, had been a witness himself. And he was so concerned about trying to just keep the government together. He just didn't want to talk about it because he thought it would, he was afraid of the ridicule, you know, really, and that it would just be such a distraction he wouldn't be able to even run the state, and he was very concerned about ridicule. And he just didn't want to talk about it at the time, and he was just trying to calm people down by joking about it. And then, but what was amazing was that he did acknowledge this 10 years later and actually came forward and said that he thought that our government should take a completely different position on this. And that if we indeed had had some kind of government office at the time that this happened, he wouldn't have had to go through what he went through. And that's something I've been advocating for. That's really my main mission now with UFOs, is to try to get an official position set up within the government, which is not easy, obviously. But he's been one of the people that's been willing to speak out for that. It's just very interesting to observe how he transformed from within those 10 years, and he wrote a really lovely statement, a two or three page chapter in my book, telling about what he saw and what it meant to him, and calling for change within the government.
You're right. It was very compelling, because I remember being so angry, you know, even though I had no stake in it at all, just as a viewer, saying, well, come on, you know, you have the mayor and making fun of the mayor, and, you know, it was horrible. And now, and then to find out that he actually witnessed it, and the complete turnaround was really, really compelling. And I give him credit.
Yeah, and a lot of the witnesses were very angry at him
for
good reason, and he apologized. He did. I mean, you have to give him credit for that, for apologizing and acknowledging what had happened.
Yeah. Is it true that President Carter had a UFO sighting?
Yeah, he did have a UFO sighting. He actually filed a report on it, which, you know, we have copies of. It was something he saw with a group of people, and he was just out, I think he was looking at the moon, and he saw something come in, and it was a colorful thing, and he didn't know what it was.
Mm.
And so he filed a report, which is to his credit, but it was nothing that nobody could really do anything with it, because, you know, unless you have a lot of data, you can't really investigate a sighting. But it was great that he did it, and he in fact, Carter, when he became president, actually tried to get NASA to reopen to look into the UFO subject. And I have a whole file of letters that went back and forth between Carter's science advisors and the appropriate counterparts at NASA. And, you know, he tried to get them to set up a little department there to kind of evaluate whether there was anything worth studying with UFOs. And even though the President of the United States requested NASA to do that, they didn't do it. They said, no, sorry, we're not going to do it.
Which also leads you to believe that if there is a lot of evidence out there, that there's a likelihood that they keep even the President of the United States in the dark about it. That's how secret.
I mean, some people speculate that that's the case. I have no way of knowing. And, you know, I try to avoid speculation, but it's
right.
Possible. I assume it's possible. I think it's more likely I think it's more likely that our government may have evidence they're not revealing for the reality of UFOs, but whether they actually understand anything more about them than we do.
Yeah,
I have no way of knowing. It's quite possible that they don't, and they just don't want to deal with something that they have absolutely no control over.
One of the more fascinating things that I read in your book is how, in many cases, the UFOs seem to anticipate the action that the sighting pilot is going to take. You know, in other words, the pilot may be about to take action, let's say to fire or to move close, and as if they seem to anticipate it and take evasive action before anything takes place. I keep thinking of the if you're thinking along the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that maybe these visitors have taken telepathic communication to a new level.
You ever think about that? It's extraordinary, yeah. I mean, and the intelligence that's demonstrated, too, with the phenomenon, that's the part that really gives me chills more than anything else. It's partly what you're describing. There are events where they seem to anticipate what's going to happen and then take action.
Right.
And there's just a lot of, and other situations, just the way they behave demonstrates a level, it's intelligent maneuvers, it's intelligent action, and it's not just sort of like there's some drone or some mechanical thing, you know?
Yeah.
And in one case, there are two cases I know of, actually, where people in cars, when there was a UFO, one of them was in Belgium, and one of them was in the upstate New York wave, the Hudson Valley wave, which were very similar to each other. And the craft were very similar, these large triangles with bright lights shining down. And in both those situations, people got out of their cars and they like flashed their headlights, let's say three times, and the craft actually responded by flashing back.
Yeah.
That to me is quite extraordinary.
It is, and
that really makes your hair stand on end.
I wish we had more time. We're going to have to, if you're willing, have to do a part two of this because there's just too much information.
I'd be happy to. Sure.
We have been talking with Leslie Kane. The book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, the website UFOsOnTheRecord.com. What I didn't get to mention is that, you know, Leslie is a world-class investigative journalist. She's not claiming that all of these sightings are real. She'll be the first to admit that 95% of them have physical explanations, but it's the 5%, you know, that she writes about. If you want to learn more about the truly credible evidence, pick up the book. It's a wonderful read, and you'll come away from it maybe a little bit changed than you were before. Leslie, thanks so much again, and we hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks so much for having me, Bob. Good night to Fran also.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind as we visualize the healing light upon Zoic McPhee, Doug Berry, Tim Donahue, Tom Donahue, Barbara Russell, Wendy Lippo, Eileen Lafata, Patty Potter, Michael Tim, Lynn Austin, Glenna Irwin, Stanley Mullen, Tanya Cash, Andy O'Brien, Johnny Jackson, Henry Stark, David Mello, Karen, Brian, Richard, Andrea, Arthur and Bernice Goforth, James Rafferty, Eddie Roll, Tracy Lee Nash, Gene Lash, Vicki Steffi, Mark Varon, Rita Springer, David Haith, Ann Hutchinson, Barbara Petillo, Julie Beischel, Marianne Pierschka, Jeanette Davies, Rachel Skandarian, Kimberly Saavedra, Donna Mello, and Tracy Bray. Now let us as one consciousness give our energy of loving thought by praying like this. to love one another, to treat others as we would like to be treated, to forgive others and return love for hate, kindness for anger, to spread this feeling to everyone, to our fellow man, as well as the earth and its environment. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.